Hi, and welcome to the Easton Bible Church podcast. We're so excited you've joined us today. Our hope is that God uses this message to help you experience a deeper, life-changing relationship with Jesus, because Jesus changes everything. Enjoy today's message.
I remember the exact moment when I realized that I had an anger management problem. I was 14 years old, and my dog had run away again. And I had tried unsuccessfully to train him to stay in the backyard. He did not like to stay in the backyard. He got bored easily. We didn't have a fence. And so he would stay in the backyard until I wasn't looking, and then he would wander off. And it got really old. I got really tired of having to chase him down. And so I was angry. He'd run off again. I had to go get him. I wasn't getting to do the things that I wanted to do. I was furious. And then on top of that, it was raining and cold and nasty outside. And I was so angry, you know, one of those spiteful moments. Like, I didn't even grab a raincoat or an umbrella. I just grabbed the leash and marched outside and slammed the door behind me and went off to find that stupid dog. And when I got to him, he didn't want to come easily. In fact, he tried to like skirt away from me real quick. I ended up having to dive to grab hold of him, and I ended up in a wet ditch, covered in wet and mold, you know, muddy leaves and just nasty, dripping wet, and I'm cold. And I take that stupid dog, put the leash on him, and begin to drag him back to the house. And I wasn't going to let him walk, right? This is where I'm teaching him a lesson. I'm dragging him. He's a German shepherd, so it took a little bit. But his front feet barely touched the ground, you know? I'm just dragging him back to the house. And we get to the back door, and I grab the doorknob, got that dog, and the door is locked. And here I am standing there, and I'm cold, and I'm angry, I'm wet, and I'm like, who locked the door, right? I mean, I went out this door, and now the door is locked. Like, who locked the door? And then I look through the glass panes, and there he is, my little brother. He's 5 years old at the time, and he thinks he's pulled a good one on me. He's dancing around. He's taunting me. He's sticking his tongue out, doing his little jig. So I start to yell at him, open this door. You better open this door right now. Oh, he's just dancing a little more, you know. He knows I can't get that door unlocked. He's just having a good old time. And I start to bang on the door. You had better open this door. And then I punched through the glass. And he vanished. It was amazing. It was like a magic trick. I've never seen a five-year-old move that quickly. It was like he was there, and then just poof, he was gone. He thought I was going to end his life. And in that moment, I pull my hand back through the door, and it's bloody, and I got glass stuck all on my hand. I still have scars. And I was so stunned, but I wasn't just stunned by the glass that's literally like hanging from my hand. I was stunned because in that moment, I had lost all control. In that moment, I didn't know who I was. In that moment, rage had overpowered me. And it wasn't until decades later, in fact, not that long ago, I was taking this personality assessment, you know, about one of those how you function and how you process information, how you work in the world, and it was incredibly accurate. It was really, really good. But the line that really stuck with me was it said, you have easy access to your anger. And I thought, that is so true. And then I thought, you know, the real problem, though, is that actually it's that my anger has easy access to me. Have you ever been shocked by something inside of you? Maybe you didn't even know it was there, but then somehow it explodes out of you, or maybe it's subtle, but as you do it, or you say it, or you have that attitude, you have that thought, you have that feeling, suddenly you're like, I don't even know who I am, and you're surprised by who you are. Jesus says that if you want to know the condition of your soul, whether it's healthy or whether it's sick, you just need to look at how you show up in the world. You have to look at the energy that you bring in the world, whether to bless or to curse or to build up or tear down, whether to heal or to harm. Like what is it that you bring into the world is a reflection of you and your soul. And it's not the reflection of you when things are going great, right? I mean, everybody thinks you look good when life is hunky-dory, everything's turning up roses, and that's when everybody looks at you and says, man, they got it together. They're so great. They're so kind. They're so compassionate. They're such great people. We love being around that guy or that girl. Now, the real question is when everything's going wrong. It's when the chips are down. That's when you begin to discover who you really are. That's the real test. And if you have an unhealthy soul, then you have an unhealthy life. And other people may not even realize this about you. You may be able to hide it from so many people, But see, everything that you struggle with in your life, you know, whether it's addiction, whether it's lust, whether it's greed, whether it's pride, whether it's anxiety, depression, all of those things are actually symptomatic of something that's much deeper inside of you. It's the health of your soul. And you might have other people fooled, but I'll tell you, at the end of the day, there's no one more deceived than you. We've been in this series talking about what does it look like to have a healthy soul. And how do we begin to take steps to have a healthier soul? And we started with kind of an obvious one, that we are to love God. We have to love God because our souls were created to love God. And if you try to love anything other than God in God's place, it's actually going to limit and stifle your soul. Because God is the only one with the capacity to contain all of your love. Everything else will actually twist and distort your love, except for God. But in loving God, it begins to change the way that we live, and it begins to realign our lives in some very difficult and challenging ways. And so what we need is to grow together. We need other people in our lives who will encourage us and support us so that we don't give up. But then thirdly, as we are growing together, that means that we have to serve one another. There's this place where we have to come alongside one another, and we do have to lift each other up. We have to encourage each other. We have to lay our lives down in order to lift somebody else's life up. And so we come to be served, but also we come to serve one another. And then that service that starts here within this body actually expands out into the world outside these walls, into our worlds of influence, our neighborhoods and our schools and our offices. And so this becomes the building blocks for what it looks like to begin to grow in our faith, to begin to have healthier souls, to love, grow, serve, and share. And then today, what I want to do is talk about one more step, if you will. But it's different than the others. It's not really a step like the others because it's one that all the others depend upon. It's the step that after you know all of those things, you have to do them. You can't just know what those steps are because they're not complicated. You actually have to begin to make these part of who you are. You have to commit to making these steps the practices of your life so that they begin to revitalize your soul. So the Apostle Paul, in his letter to the Corinthians church, in 1 Corinthians 9:24, he says this, "Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training, and they do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body and make it my slave so that after I've preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize." I love sports. I love watching sports. Right now, I love watching my kids play sports. We have a lot of games to attend. I got four kids playing, I think, five or six different sports right now. It's a little bit crazy. But I tell you, I love watching sports. I love watching professional sports, too. I'll admit it. I love watching the best of the best, those elite athletes who can perform feats that seem almost superhuman. So I love watching sports, and I've been to lots of live sporting events, and I enjoy all of that. And it's so interesting, though, that we often think in our modern time that we're the ones who invented this whole athletic competition thing. We like to think that the way that we do it has never been done before. You know, we got our big stadiums, and we've got our corporate sponsors, and we've got athletes making endorsements of products, and we've got this whole, it's big business, the way that we do sports. And we think that this is like new. It's actually been going on for thousands of years. See, in Corinth, where this church is that Paul is writing to, they hosted something like the Olympic Games. It wasn't the Olympic Games. The Olympic Games were the most popular in that part of the world, but the second most popular were the Isthmian Games that were part of Corinth. And they hosted them every other spring, and it was big business. It had been going on since the 6th century BC. I mean, it's a long, long time. And drew these enormous crowds, an enormous revenue for the city. All these people would come in, and there were corporate sponsors, and they had stadiums, and they had athletes doing endorsements of products. And it brought all this money into the city. And probably, by the way, Paul himself benefited from it. Because when Paul lived there, he would, on the side, if you will, he had a side hustle going on of making tents to support himself financially. And so it's pretty likely that Paul was probably selling tents to the people who were coming to watch these games. And so Paul, he's drawing on the popularity of these athletic competitions that this church would have known so well. And he starts with this question. I love this. Do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Paul says, look, I'm going to ask you a really simple question. Do you know how to race or not? Do you know how to run a race? It's really simple. It's a really simple question. Everyone knows how to run a race. You start here, you try to get to there before everybody else. It's really simple. Every kid at recess knows how to run a race. And Paul says, listen, if you are running a race, then you run to win. If you're in a competition, you are running to win. See, there's a difference between being in the race and running the race. You can be in a race and not really run. But he says, look, if you're running the race, then you are running to win. There's a purpose. There's a drive behind it. And Paul says, it is as absurd, just like it would be absurd to run a race not to win, not to give it everything you have, not to run as hard as you can. It would be just as absurd not to live your life with everything that you have. It'd be absurd not to live your life giving it everything that's within you, leaving it all on the field, all on the track. I've played and coached a lot of sports, and I'll tell you, the only thing that really drives me crazy, especially as a coach, is when I see players who are not giving it everything they have, when they're not really trying. They're just mailing it in. I remember this one time I was coaching one of my kids, probably like 10-year-old baseball teams, and so they knew how to play hard. They weren't the best baseball players, but they knew how to play hard. If nothing else, they knew how to hustle. But there was one kid who, he's a sweet kid, but he just didn't want to try. He didn't want to play hard. I don't know if his parents made him play baseball and somehow he got stuck on this team, but he didn't really want to try. And so he would never run hard. He would never swing hard. You know, it was just one of those really, for me, very frustrating kids. Did I mention I have easy access to my anger? And so one time we were coaching this game and he was on second base. I have no idea how he got there. I can only assume, looking back, that they walked him and then they walked the next guy, and so somehow he ended up on second. But then as he was standing on second, the batter hit a ball, and now he had to run to third. And you could tell he just didn't really want to. Bless his heart, you know. And he sort of started half jogging to third, and I'm the third base coach, and I'm yelling, run! You gotta run! Come on! And there's a coach in the dugout behind me. I can hear him yelling, run! You gotta run! And so he sort of half jogs, and he gets close to the bag, not even to the bag, and he pulls up, and he walks the rest of the way. I don't know how, but he was safe. I mean, maybe so many errors in the outfield. I don't know how in the world it happened, but somehow he was safe. But I was so frustrated in that moment. I literally, tagged in the other coach. I was like, I'm out. He's on third. You're gonna have to deal with him. I can't deal with this. See, why would you play if you're not going to try? Like, that doesn't make sense to me. It still doesn't make sense to me. Like, as a coach, I can live with mistakes. I can live with failure. But if you're going to make a mistake, make it with gusto. You know what I mean? Like go all in and make your mistake. If you're going to fail, fail spectacularly, right? Give it everything you have and fail big. Like, why be half-hearted? Right? Why do it only a little bit? It's interesting, a few years ago, I was curious to learn what people's biggest regrets are when they get to the end of their life. And there's actually several studies that they've talked to different people right at the end of their life. What is your biggest regret? And without fail, the number one, when you look at all the data, comes back that their biggest regret is that they didn't take more risks, that they didn't leave it all on the field, they didn't give it everything that they had. Odds are that when you get to the end of your life, you're going to look back and your biggest regret or one of your biggest regrets will be that you didn't do everything that you could have to make the most out of your life. That at some point, you pulled back instead of leaning in. And maybe it's with a relationship. Maybe it's with your career. Maybe it's some other opportunity. But at some point, you played not to lose instead of playing to win. And what I find so fascinating is that Christians can be some of the most risk-averse people that you know. I mean, we can be so risk-averse. We want to play it safe. You know, we're afraid of change, and we can be afraid of the future. And yet, we talk so often about faith. And faith at its very core, at the very heart of what faith is, it involves risk. You can't have faith without risk. And when you break it down, I mean, what we believe is risky. We are betting our lives that there is a God that you cannot see, taste, or touch. We are betting everything about us on the idea that there is a God who became one of us, that Jesus came to earth, became one of us, died, and rose again from the dead. These are claims that we cannot prove scientifically, that I cannot prove beyond a shadow of a reasonable doubt. But we're betting our lives on that because the Christian life, to walk the Christian life, isn't one about certainty. It's actually a life of faith. That's the whole point, is to believe and to trust in God, that he is who he says he is. That's what faith is. And see, one of the reasons that we get so uncomfortable following Jesus, I think, is because he is far less risk-averse than we are. See, when we look at our lives, we like to play it safe, you know, and we like to stay in the boat. And it's windy and there's waves out there, and we want to stay warm and safe in the boat. And Jesus is trying to get us out of the boat so that we can walk on the water. And see, if you don't think that God is calling you to a place in your life of discomfort, of risk, in order to stretch your faith, then you don't understand what he is doing in your life. You don't understand his greatest desire for you, who he has created you to be and who he is trying to make you into. And you need to ask yourself, are you actually following Jesus, or are you actually just still sitting in the boat? Because you were created for faith, not fear. A few years ago, I was came across this article about New Jersey's very own Carly Lloyd, who I just found out, somebody told me after the last service, is from the town we live in Delran. I had no idea. Blew my mind. And Carly Lloyd, if you're not familiar with her name, probably most of you are, since she's like a hometown girl here. She is, at the time of the article, she was arguably the greatest women's soccer player in the world. She was unbelievable. She was the face of women's soccer here in the United States. She was incredible. And what I found so interesting in this article is that no one ever questioned her talent. Right? Nobody ever questioned whether she was gifted. She was clearly an unbelievably gifted soccer player. And yet there came a time in her career where she almost walked away from the game because she felt like she wasn't living up to her potential. And she felt like she was letting herself down and she was letting her teammates down, and she almost gave up. But she connected with this coach who challenged her to commit to her training in a whole new way, a whole new level. And it wasn't just the intensity of the training. All of that took a major step up, but also it became a day in and day out, never stop training. Every day, Christmas, birthdays, vacations, holidays, she never took a day off because that's what it took to become the greatest. It's the Apostle Paul. He says this: everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. It's not, you don't just get up and you just start running. You don't get up and just start competing. No, you go into strict training. He says they do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. See, if you were going to compete in the games in Corinth, you actually were required to go into a period of training over months, and then you had to actually give proof that you had gone through all this training so that you could be qualified to be entered into the race or the competition, whatever it was. Because they didn't want you just to wing it. They didn't want you to just show up and try to do something. They wanted to make sure that if you were going to run the race, you were going to be ready to run your best race. They wanted real competition. And they did it, I love this, to receive a crown. It was probably a wreath that was woven, and it was made out of, get this, withered celery. I know, I'm like, why would you run for that? That doesn't sound really appealing to me. I'm really glad they moved on to gold medals for the Olympics, you know, instead of withered celery. It couldn't be fresh because then it would break. I mean, you had to let it, like, wither. Doesn't that sound great? Withered celery. Walking around that with that on your head, you got to feel special in that moment, right? I got to tell you, though, I'm kind of down with this whole food-based prize thing, though. I mean, look, who among us has not promised ourselves an extra donut if we go to the gym, right? Come on. Come on. We've all been, I'm going to run an extra mile and then I get an extra brownie. See, this is how we play games. You know, we like those food prizes. My wife, Carrie, was running the Chicago Marathon a couple years ago. And her self-selected prize, her reward for herself, was that night we were gonna eat deep dish Chicago style pizza. All right, see, that's motivating. It was great. I didn't even have to run the marathon, and I got some. It worked out really well. You know, here's the thing, though, is that if Chicago somehow had run out of pizza that day, like there was no pizza available, she could not have the pizza she was craving that she was running, she still would have run the race. Probably. I haven't asked her. I feel strongly, though, she would have run the race. Because the prize is just a prize. It just signifies what you have accomplished. And see, there, in some sense, it doesn't really matter what the prize is. See, some people look at this and they think that Paul's talking about a literal crown, and maybe he is. But the prize is almost irrelevant. It's only a symbol of the achievement. It's proof to everyone else to signify what you have accomplished, that you ran your best race. And see, that is why you commit to train. So at the end of the race, you can say, I gave it everything I had. At the end of the race, you can know that you ran your best race. A couple years ago, actually been a few years now, a buddy of mine decided that he was going to run a marathon without training. He was not a young man at the time. And he hadn't trained at all. He hadn't built up his stamina. He didn't change his diet. To my knowledge, he's only run a couple of times leading up to this, but I think he had a birthday and had a crisis and decided, today I'm proving to myself I'm still young, and so I'm going to run a marathon. And so he charted it out, he walked out his front door and just started running. He almost died. I'm pretty sure by the end of it, he wished he had. See, the quality of your race is going to be determined by the quality of your training. If you don't train, how could you ever expect to run a good race? And it's the same with our lives. If you have not trained your heart to hope and to love, then why are you surprised that you feel hopeless and afraid? If you've never trained your heart to trust God with your future, then why are you surprised when as obstacles come into your way that you feel like giving up and it derails your life? See, unless you commit to training and you dig into all that God has for you, love, grow, serve, share, unless you commit to that training, then you will never be prepared when you hit the wall. See, every long-distance runner knows what it is to hit the wall. That's this moment in the race where you feel like you've literally hit a wall, where you are so tired, you are so fatigued, you feel like there is almost no way you could possibly take another step forward. And for some runners, for some racers, that is the end of their race. But some power through. And see, in the race that is your life, you are going to hit so many walls. I mean, some of you know that. You have hit wall after wall after wall, and you continue to struggle through them, or maybe you've given up. I don't know. But in your life, you're not going to just hit a wall. You're going to hit multiple walls. It's not a question of whether you will hit the wall. The question is, what will you do when you hit the wall? The question is whether you will respond by powering through or whether you will give up, whether you have the inner strength and the resource and the resolve to say, this wall will not stop me, or whether you sit down at the side of the road. And see, the real battle, then, isn't with the wall. Not really. The real battle is the battle that takes place inside of you. The battle isn't with the circumstances that you are running into that feel so strong. The real battle is the battle that takes place inside of your mind. Do you ever feel like there are negative emotions and thoughts that have control of you? And they're the emotions and thoughts that you don't want to have, but you can't seem to get rid of them, and they're overpowering your life, they're controlling your life. And see, what happens is we hit the wall, and the wall is painful. It hurts when you hit the wall, and then we respond with these emotions of pain. Whether it's fear, whether it's hurt, whether it's worry, right? We respond with these emotions, but then those emotions begin to generate our thoughts. And those thoughts begin to overwhelm us. And they actually end up fueling those same negative emotions so that our emotions fuel our thoughts that then reinforce our emotions, that reinforce our thoughts. And it becomes this vicious negative cycle that pulls us down until we are out of the race entirely. See, you hit the wall and it hurts and you start to feel like you're worthless. And then you start to tell yourself you're worthless. And pretty soon, you're out. And see, the only way to break that cycle is to change your thoughts. The only way to break that cycle is that as those thoughts come into your head, that you're hopeless, that you're defeated, that you're worthless, that you take those thoughts captive. This is what Paul says in another letter to the Corinthians. You take those thoughts captive and you make them obedient to Jesus and what he says about you, because that's what's true. And so as these thoughts come into your mind, you take hold of them and you look at them and go, oh, wait, is this true? Like right now, I feel like I'm worthless. And so I'm telling myself, I'm so worthless. But wait a minute, Jesus says that I have infinite value to him. And then I grab hold of that thought and allow it to replace that other thought. And that's the only way that you can break the cycle. You run into the wall and you go, man, I'm defeated, I'm hopeless. And you begin to tell yourself that over and over and over again. And then you stop and you go, hey, Jesus says that actually I have eternal hope in him. I don't have to feel defeated because he has the victory that I need. And I grab hold of that thought and allow it to push out the other thoughts in my head. I hold on to that one with everything that I have. See, it is not bad to have thoughts and emotions, okay? They're not the problem. That's part of what it is to be human. The problem is when we allow those thoughts and emotions that are antithetical to God's desire for us and who we were created to be to have control over us. The thoughts are going to pop into your head. You can't prevent that, but you have the power to take hold of these thoughts, to take them captive, and to say, Jesus, is this true? And then to replace it when it's not with something that is true that he has told you about yourself. You can't control the emotions that you feel. When you hit the wall, it hurts. Those emotions come into you, and there's nothing that you can do to stop them, but what you can do is tell yourself that those emotions will not define you. You can tell yourself that those emotions, while they are valid, because it hurts when you hit the wall, that you do not have to act on those emotions indiscriminately. You have that control. And see, when you have that inner self-discipline and when you have that mastery over yourself, then those circumstances cannot win over you. Those circumstances that you've run into, it cannot tell you who you are unless you allow it to. At the end of the day, you are the only one who can take you out of your own race. This is why Paul says you got to train. You got to train. You got to train your mind and your heart. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. He says, no, I beat my body and make it my slave so that after I've preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. I'll tell you one more marathon story. My wife, Carrie, was running a marathon in Irving, Texas, so where you guys are. And it's not a huge marathon, but it's a good-sized marathon. But at least at the time, the course was really confusing. And it was like this big kind of convoluted loop, and you had to do it twice. But to make it even more fun, they change it the second time. And so you run it one way, and the second time you're running almost the same one, but then you have to change. And so Carrie, along with several hundred other people, got off course. And they looped around the wrong side, and then a lot of them, like my wife, realized that they were in the wrong place, and so they kind of did the loop twice in order to get back on track. So they actually ended up running further than the marathon required. And Carrie ended up having a really strong race. It wasn't her best, but it was really strong. She finished first in her age bracket. We were really excited about that until we found out that she'd been disqualified, which didn't seem fair to me because she ran further than the marathon. But I am biased. See, here's the sobering reality. You can run your race and you can cross the finish line, but you can run in such a way that it doesn't count for anything. And what Paul's saying here is that you have to have mastery over yourself. You have to have self-control. He's not talking about abusing yourself, by the way. When he says, beat myself, this isn't physical abuse. He's not talking about flogging yourself or beating yourself up. No, he's saying have self-control, self-restraint, self-discipline, so that in the final calculation, your life will count. This week, I was talking to my mom, who is a piano teacher. We were on the phone. She's a very accomplished piano teacher. She has received awards for her teaching, and she has students, so many students who've won competitions and gone on to study music at some really prestigious schools. She's very, very good at what she does. My mom has a very unique gift. It's really beautiful. She always makes everyone else feel like they're the smartest person in the room. That is a gift, by the way. She always asks questions of you that she actually knows more than you do. And so we're talking on the phone, and she began to ask me about the student that she has, who is trying to win a competition that's coming up, but he is struggling to achieve all that he wants in his music. He's struggling to really accomplish his goals, to get to reach his highest potential before the competition. And so she was asking if I had any ideas about how to practice the piano. Keep in mind, I have not seriously practiced the piano in a couple of decades, and she was my teacher. So everything that I know, she knows. And not only that, but everything I know, I'm sure she has told the student. And so I just started talking, and I was like, well, you know, you could try this, you could try this. And I stopped, and I thought, wait a minute, she knows everything I'm asking, but she just likes me to feel like I know something. She's very gracious to me like that. But finally, what I ended up saying was, you know, when it really comes down to it, it's not whether he knows what to do. The question is, will he do what he knows? The question is, will he have the discipline? Will he have the commitment? Will he have the drive to say, I will do whatever it takes to reach the goals that I have? See, I can stand up here and I can tell you that God has created you for a life that is more than mere existence. You have to decide whether you will pursue the life that only God has given you or whether you will settle for less. Whether you will do whatever it takes to run your best race. And it's not tricky to get started. It's everything that we've talked about these last several weeks. Love, grow, serve, share. It's not rocket science. At a very practical level, just ask yourself, are you loving God? You know, are you reading his scriptures? Are you getting into his word, allowing him to speak into your life, allowing his heart to begin to mold yours? We get into God's word so that God's word gets into us. Are you spending time in prayer, both sharing the requests that you have and the things that are on your heart, but also listening for his heart to speak back to you? Is it a conversation? Like, are you here at church? I know you're here at church right now. Some of you, I don't know how to tell you this, we're here every week. It's crazy. Some of you didn't know that. We're actually here every Sunday. Are you really invested in this community? Or are you just browsing? You know, are you invested in the lives of other people? Are you growing together with other people who are going to challenge you and push you and hold you accountable? Are you holding everybody at arm's length? Are you sharing your life with the people in your life? See, it's not complicated. Love, grow, serve, share. It's not rocket science. I started the series several weeks ago with this quote from G.K. Chesterton, and it's one of my favorites, and I'll share it many times in the future, I'm sure. He says, the Christian life has not been tried and found wanting. It's been found difficult and left untried. What are you willing to try? What are you willing to commit to? What are you willing to say no to in order to say yes to what God wants to do in you? How long are you going to keep running your race as though your life doesn't depend upon it? What are you willing to do to grab hold of the life that only God has for you? Like, what's it going to take for you to stop relying on yourself? What's it going to take for you to stop relying on what you can read about pop psychology or self-help so you can sort of stimulate this in yourself so you can get through your life? What's it going to take for you to stop grasping hold of the things that will numb the pain of your life or distract you from the aimlessness of your life? What is it going to take for you to finally run your race to win? What's it going to take for you to pursue the life that only God has for you, to take hold of the life that you were created for? What is it going to take for you to finally commit and say, I'm all in? I will do what it takes. I want to run my best race so that when I get to the end, I will hear Jesus say, well done. Man, I'm proud of you. You ran your best race. It wasn't perfect, but you gave it everything you had. After our second son was born, after Jude was born, I was talking to my friend Chris Howell. And Chris Howell is one of the most gifted guitarists I've ever known. I mean, he really is incredible. It's what he does as a living. And Chris would tell you that he prefers to play his guitar than to speak because he finds that he can more accurately communicate through music and through the sound that he can generate from his guitar than with words. And because of that, Chris is a man of few words. And so one time I was talking with him and I was complaining to him. I was whining because we have these two kids, and Chris has a family too, by the way, and we have these two kids and we're so busy and we're not sleeping and we're exhausted. I've got my job and everything's just hard. I'm whining and complaining to him, and Chris is just sort of like strumming away on his guitar, and evidently what he was trying to communicate to me was not getting through. And so finally he stopped playing the guitar and actually used words to say, if you're not exhausted, you're not doing it right. I'm telling you right now, if you're not exhausted, then you are not doing it right. It's only when you're exhausted, by the way, that when you lay down at night and you rest, because you were created for rest as well, that it truly feels beautiful, doesn't it? It's a long, hard, real day, honest work. You lay down and you go, oh yeah, that's rest. See, some of you, listen, you feel exhausted by your life. Guess what? Me too. Join the club. Who told you that life was easy? I mean, who told you that you only had to run downhill the whole time? Who told you that you never have to fight in order to get through the wall? Can I tell you something in case you've never been told this in your life? Everything that is worth doing is hard. And if you've never heard that before, let me tell you one more time, because some of you need to hear this. Everything that is worth doing is hard. And if you're good with your life just being, you know, okay, whatever it is, if you don't mind if it doesn't really count for anything, you don't mind if you just sort of waste most of it, then by all means, don't try. Don't do hard things. Only run when it's easy, when it's downhill. But if you want to take hold of the life that God created you for, if you want to take hold of a life that matters and you want to seize the prize, then run after Jesus with everything you have. And you grab hold of that prize that he's holding out for you, because he already pursued you that way. Jesus, and you were the prize that he was chasing after. Don't you see that Jesus, man, he didn't play it safe in order to save you. He didn't take the path of least resistance. He didn't take the easy way out. No, he walked through the valley of the shadow of death so that we could be freed from sin, so that we could have forgiveness, so that we could have eternal life with him. And if you've never given your life to him, I'm telling you, you are running the wrong race. Because the prize that you are looking for, that your heart is longing for, it's him. He is the prize you've been looking for all of your life. He is the way, the truth, and the life that your soul is longing to take hold of. And when you give your life to him, man, he comes into your life and he says, let me give you the life that you were made for, a life of fullness, a life of abundance. It's the life you've always wanted. If you're here this morning and you have never given your life to Jesus, you've never even begun to start this race, I want you to know that you can start. You can cross that line of the starting line into this journey, moving from death into life, right now by giving your life to Jesus. That is the race that you were created to run. And if you've been running for a long time, but man, you're not really dialed in, you're just sort of running in circles, you're just kind of half walking, can I tell you that you do not want to get to the end of your life and look back with regrets, that you didn't leave it all on the track, you didn't leave it all on the field. You don't want to look back at the rest of your life and realize, man, it didn't really count for anything. And don't let that be your story. Don't let that be your story. Let me pray for us. Jesus, you are the prize that we long for. You are the prize that for which we were created. We just want to grasp hold of the life that you have for us. And to hear you say, well done, when we get to the end of the line, the end of the race, well done, good and faithful servant. Lord, if there's anybody here right now, and maybe they're at this place where they have never taken that first step across the starting line, they are still on the wrong side of faith. And maybe they're sitting right now and just realizing that they've been running the wrong race. And maybe they're beginning to realize, because you're pressing on their hearts, that maybe, just maybe, you hold what they've been looking for all of their lives. And Lord, I pray that right now you would give them the courage simply to speak to you and to say, Jesus, I want the life that only you have. I give you my life. If that's your prayer right now, I just want to just challenge you, just encourage you. Right now, you can say that to Jesus. Jesus, I want the life that only you have. I give you my life. And if that's your prayer, then Jesus, man, he is there to meet you. You have just taken this first step, and it's not the whole journey. That's just the beginning. But if that's your prayer, we would love to talk with you, and I hope you'll come find me, talk to the elder up front. We'd love to walk alongside you in this new life that you have, this new life of faith. Lord, if there's others of us here, and we've been running for many, many years, but let's be honest, sometimes we're more walking in place than really running after you. So Lord, I pray that you would just give us the courage, you would give us the strength, you would give us the energy, Lord, to take even that first step and then to discover that you were there all along. That even as we took that first step, it was always you. It was always your strength in us. God, you have the strength that we need. Life is hard. There are walls that we got to run through. God, I pray that you would just, Lord, just continue to run with us. Pull us to yourself. Give us the right thoughts, the thoughts that we need to direct our lives towards you. Lord, I pray that today we would begin even just to make one small commitment that we want to love you. Maybe it's that we want to grow with others. Maybe it's that we want to serve others. Maybe it's we want to share our lives with the people in our lives. Lord, I pray that this week we would be serious about what it looks like to run our race well and to discover the joy of running with you. It's in your name we pray. Amen.
Thanks for listening to the Easton Bible Church podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's message and that God will use it to speak powerfully into your life. If you have questions about how you can have a relationship with Jesus or would like more information about our church, you can connect with us on Instagram and Facebook or go to the Easton Bible Church website at ebc.org.